This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The Disorganization of American Labor. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is an archived edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. On the AFL-CIO's 50th birthday, it lost 25% of its members and a big chunk of its budget. The Teamsters and Service Employees International unions created the biggest split in the labor movement since the Depression. On To the Point, organized labor is on the decline. Is the split about principle or personality and money? Can the dissenting unions restart the organized labor movement, or has it become irrelevant to the globalized economy? We'll repeat a program recorded during July's historic breakup of the AFL-CIO. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with an archived Labor Day edition of To the Point. In July, the AFL-CIO gathered to celebrate its 50th birthday, only to see its two biggest unions go their own way. Since then, others have followed. On To the Point, has organized labor become irrelevant in the globalized economy, or is it more important than ever? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the restoration of Iraq's southern marshlands. First, this news update. Appellate Judge John Roberts goes back before the Senate Judiciary Committee tomorrow as the president's choice to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman member of the U.S. Supreme Court. The only woman member of the committee is California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, and she is under pressure to get tough on the question of a woman's right to abortion. Michael Doyle reports from Washington for the Sacramento Bee. Michael, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Senator Feinstein, has been a consistent questioner of judicial nominees on that subject.
She has, and she's made emphasis. She's underscored the fact that she is the only woman among the 18-member panel. And in a speech a week or so ago in California, she said that as a result of that unique position, she was going to place special emphasis on the Roe v. Wade question. The interesting thing that viewers may want to watch for is that there will be at least four other pro-choice senators asking their questions before Senator Feinstein. And so by the time Feinstein gets her chance at bat, Judge Roberts will have had a chance to answer and perhaps hone his answers to the question. So for Senator Feinstein, the question maybe become, how does she try to elaborate upon what has already been asked and answered?
Is she under special pressure because she's a woman from women's groups who are very concerned about a possible challenge to Roe versus Wade coming from the high court?
Well, I think there is some pressure. Congresswoman Maxine Waters has been quoted as saying that she believes Senator Feinstein wants to burnish her centrist, rather feminist, credentials. And from Congresswoman Waters, that was a bit of a shot across the bow. On the other hand, Senator Feinstein is in an extremely strong position. She's well-regarded both as a centrist and as an upholder of abortion rights. And she herself is, I think, proud of resisting pressure from interest groups. So she will feel the pressure, but so will Senator Biden, who is interested in being president. So will Senator Kennedy. So, for that matter, will Senator Specter, a pro-choice Republican who chairs the committee. So the pressure will be felt on all members, not just Senator Feinstein.
Back to Senator Feinstein. If she needs burnishing of her feminist credentials, I would gather it comes partly because when this same judge was first appointed to the appellate court, she supported him.
Well, she did, and she's spoken very highly of him, of his intellect, of his demeanor, of his judicial temperament. And it, in some senses, would be difficult for her to vote against him now. Her argument might be, as a Supreme Court justice, he would be setting precedent, and therefore his views are all the more important. We should remember that when Judge Roberts was asked previously in his first confirmation hearing about Roe v. Wade, he said it is considered the settled law of the land. Now, that's a very powerful answer. And if he offers it again, Senator Feinstein and others may have a very difficult time shaking him from that.
This is, again, we're talking with Michael Doyle, who's with the Sacramento Bee in Washington. You mentioned Judge Roberts using that phrase, the settled law of the land, to describe Roe versus Wade. And you also mentioned the precedent issue on the court. What's the connection?
Well, currently Judge Roberts sits on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, sometimes called the second highest court of the land. It is an appellate court, and it reviews trial judge rulings. It is bound by what the Supreme Court says is the national law, and therefore, by saying Roe v. Wade is the settled law of the land, Judge Roberts was saying he would not be creating new national law as an appellate judge. Now, as a Supreme Court justice, it would be within his power, if he could find a majority, to overturn precedent and to create new law. And so an appellate judge is bound more tightly by the past and by the higher court than the Supreme Court, because, of course, there is no higher court than the Supreme Court. So the settled law question goes only so far. Senator Schumer from New York, probably Senator Feinstein and others, will want to press the judge and as to whether he would be willing to overturn precedent and under what conditions.
And after all, one of the reasons that it is settled law at the moment is because of Sandra Day O'Connor, who's leaving.
Well, that's right. To say it's something that's settled law a little bit begs the question as to settled under what circumstances. It only takes five justices to overturn settled law, and at the current time, there are three justices, Rehnquist, Thomas, and Scalia, who have indicated an interest in overturning Roe. Even if Judge Roberts would want to join them, that would still be a minority. Then it would be up to the next justice nominee that would really then turn the question.
We've just got about 20 seconds left. Do you think that Judge Roberts is going to have a hard time before the Judiciary Committee or not?
I think he's going to have a heck of a good time, actually. I think he'll be confirmed. I think he'll face tough questions. He'll hit many out of the park. I think people will see a man of considerable intellect and charm and good humor. I think that he will face tough questions, and I think he'll face them commendably well.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Michael Doyle, reporting from Washington for the Sacramento Bee. In a moment, disorganization in American labor on this archived edition of To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Werman, I'll be back with this archived edition of To the Point. 2 months ago, the AFL-CIO consisted of 56 unions. Now there are 53. Between them, the Teamsters and Service Employees International took 25% of the AFL-CIO's working members and a lot of its budget. The United Food and Commercial Workers then pulled out, too. The July convention was intended originally to celebrate 50 years of a united labor movement, but the birthday party turned sour. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect and a columnist for the Washington Post and the L.A. Weekly. I asked him what caused the rift.
The problem, of course, is the movement is a lot weaker than it was 50 years ago, and with those weaknesses have come some frustrations, some tensions, some divisions, and now some secessions with possibly more to follow. So there's a sense of the people remaining, of the folks who are being seceded from, rather than the seceders themselves, of anger, of bitterness, of sorrow, a lot of second-guessing, why did this have to happen, the differences aren't that great, there are no real ideological or constituency differences here. So lots of questions, and the biggest one is where do we go from here and what happens now?
When you said that the movement is weaker than it was 50 years ago, is there a sense at the convention that it's weaker than it was the day before yesterday?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, it's a sense of crisis. I mean, just to begin with, the AFL-CIO itself, obviously it's already made some major cuts in staff and programs. It's actually eliminated its international affairs division, but now it's going to have to do more. And the particular flashpoint right now, which is being addressed just actually within the last hour, is what happens to all the central labor councils and state federations. This is where the actual political work of American labor usually is conducted, the get-out-the-vote operations and such. There are a lot of central labor councils in a lot of cities where SEIU and the Teamsters are disproportionately a dominant force in the labor movements of those cities that are saying, wait a minute, it's one thing to pull out of the national organization, but it doesn't make any sense to pull out of our local councils. And here's where there's some tension in several different ways emerging. The original position of the AFL-CIO in its constitution says if you're not an affiliate of the national organization, you can't belong to central labor councils and state federations. Sometimes those have been ignored. President John Sweeney of the AFL-CIO had said going into the convention that he intended to enforce that so that if SEIU, for instance, left the national AFL-CIO, it would have to withdraw from, for instance, the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor, the Central Labor Council of New York and Chicago, etc. But you're getting lots of folks from the Central Labor Councils and the state federations saying this will be a crisis for us. And the unions that are withdrawing, both SEIU and the Teamsters yesterday, made clear they want to stay affiliated with the state federations and local councils. So just within the last 20 minutes, Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, told us in a press conference that actually no decision is going to be made on this here in Chicago. They will have a special meeting of their executive council in several weeks to discuss this conundrum about what to do with the state and local bodies of the AFL-CIO.
Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect, columnist for the Washington Post and the LA Weekly. Stephen Lerner is director of the Property Services Division of the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU. Mr. Lerner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Harold Meyerson said there is a sense of crisis now at the convention. Did you and the Teamsters and the other unions that are considered dissenters here create a crisis?
The crisis has been brewing and was created years ago when the crisis started hitting American workers. American workers, because unions haven't organized and are weaker, have been losing health care, have been losing pensions. You have to look no farther than the airline industry to see the crisis workers are facing. And so we think what needs to be addressed is the crisis workers are facing, and that we can make dramatic changes and need to make dramatic changes to help workers build the strength they need to make their lives better. So our issue isn't whether there's a crisis in Chicago at a convention. Our issue is a crisis for the millions of workers who can't pay their bills and don't have health insurance for their children.
What then would you say to, I know you are more interested in organizing new workers than you are in paying a lot of money for political campaigns, although we can get to that in a moment. But what will you say to new people, not at the moment a part of the organized labor movement, in order to get them into it, about these dramatic changes that you're looking forward to?
Well, our union has grown by 900,000 people in over the last 10 years, and it's because we have a strategy of organizing whole industries at once and really making a difference in workers' lives by creating the kind of strength you need to take on giant global corporations. So we're going to say more of what we've been saying, which is workers can win despite the obstacles if we approach this correctly, and that there is a moment of hope and opportunity in this country and around the world where workers can say, if we put our resources into organizing, if we're willing to take the risk, if we focus our attention, that we can take on these companies and win the kind of things that workers need and demand now.
Has the AFL-CIO, under its current leadership, become, as some have phrased it, a satellite of the Democratic Party, too involved with one party?
Well, what I would say is that we can't depend on any political party. Workers can't depend on for their fortune, that we need to support candidates or parties that are going to support workers and their issues. And part of the problem now is the reason we're losing elections is not because people don't have a good political campaign. We fundamentally don't have enough members. The math isn't in our favor. The reason Kerry partly lost was because we couldn't win the state of Ohio. The way we'll start winning politically is by organizing hundreds of thousands of new workers so that we have the numbers and the strength that Harold referred to that we used to have, so we can influence politics, we can take on companies, and we can win the kind of benefits that workers need.
In 1968, I believe it was, the Teamsters famously endorsed Richard Nixon for president. Do you see that happening again by either the SEIU or the Teamsters?
I think on, in terms of the presidential, that we were, all of our unions were completely united behind John Kerry. We put incredible resources into it. So I don't see any scenario in which we would endorse a candidate like Richard Nixon. What I think you will find is
another Republican, obviously. We're not going to go back to Nixon.
We've endorsed Republicans, Democrats, independents who support the rights of workers. And especially on a state and local level, you'll often find that there are politicians who support workers' right to organize, who support the kind of thing we're doing. So what we're saying is workers need to leave all their options open. And the idea that we would only support Democrats, the Democratic Party, which, to be frank, is not always pro-union. We have people in the Democratic Party that vote for trade bills that are bad for workers, and we don't feel we should then turn around and support them despite the fact that they voted against us.
Stephen Lerner, once again, Director of the Property Services Division of the Service Employees International Union, one of those that has pulled away from the AFL-CIO. Andy Levin is at the convention this week. He heads up the Voice at Work campaign of the AFL-CIO, which helps workers gain the right to organize. He also is formerly an organizer with the SEIU. Andy Levin, this must be a particularly painful moment for you.
Thanks for having me, Warren. Well, yesterday was a sad day, and I was angry when my own union decided to divide the labor movement over really what are very small differences, but a lot of rhetoric.
Why do you say the differences are small, given what we heard just now from Stephen Lerner and given the decline in the labor movement in terms of its numbers and its effectiveness politically?
Because I and we agree with virtually everything that Stephen has said. There's a major crisis for workers in this country. They've effectively lost the right to organize. They've lost pensions and health insurance, and their wages are stagnant and declining. The income and wage gaps are growing, and it's because we're not organizing fast enough. And we just think we can do it better united than divided. I mean, for example, Stephen talks about the need to do big campaigns, global campaigns that take on these giant corporations. Well, the AFL-CIO designed and implemented with a union called the Graphic Communications Industrial Union, which has just now joined the Teamsters, one of the dissidents, a campaign to take on the second largest printing company in the world, Quebecor. It's based in Canada. Its workers are unionized in Canada. They're unionized in Europe and Brazil and so forth. And yet here they fight workers and refuse to let them organize freely. So we ran a global campaign. We had Quebecor workers from a dozen countries in Mississippi doing house visits. We had the a minister of education from another country telling the company that they would no longer allow them to print their textbooks if they didn't respect workers' rights to organize in the United States. And we won a neutrality agreement. An agreement that allows these workers to organize freely in the United States. And now, last week in Fernley, Ohio, Fernley, Nevada, the first group organized, and more groups are organizing. So we agree with Stephen. The point is, if you don't get your way exactly, you don't just pick up your marbles and go home. I mean, the behavior of the Change to Win leadership reminds me of the way my sister was when we used to play Monopoly when we were kids. And if I built too many hotels on property and it looked like she was going to lose, she said, game over.
Do you think that this is as much about personality and money as anything else? It's been reported that Andy Stern, now the head of the SEIU, is very ambitious and feels competitive with John Sweeney, even though he came from the same union and was once a mentor to Andy Stern, and that the Teamsters need the money, and they need it to keep their union afloat.
Well, I'm afraid it very much is. It's a power struggle, plain and simple. For example, on the money question, they have asked that one of their big policy proposals was that they get a 50% rebate from the AFL-CIO on the dues they pay if they spend 10% of their budget on organizing. And guess what? That's a threshold that fits the Teamsters exactly. Well, John Sweeney, a decade ago, called on all unions to spend 30% or more of their budget on organizing. And if just two of the unions in their coalition, the Teamsters and the United Food and Commercial Workers, went from the 10% or less of their budget they spend on organizing today to 30%, it would add more new money to organizing than a 50% rebate for the entire membership of all of our unions. So it is about money, and it is about a power struggle. And what we say is we love new ideas. We love their vision. We certainly need to change as fast as possible. Let's do it together. Let's not divide the labor movement. And we're going to keep reaching out and trying to create unity and not division.
Andy Levin with the AFL-CIO. Back to Stephen Lerner with the SEIU, Service Employees International. What do you say to all of that? The philosophical differences aren't that great. Why not get together or stay together?
You know, it's always funny when somebody you have a disagreement with claims there's really not a disagreement. What it reminds me of is when you're negotiating with an employer and the employer says, well, I agree I should pay you more money, or I agree that there should be a grievance procedure that protects you, but I don't believe I should have to do it. I believe that it's sort of up to me whether I want to do it. And the bottom line is there's core philosophical and different issues. We believe that there should be industry-wide unions that are focused on organizing one industry, that they're not organizing 20 or 30 industries. We believe that there shouldn't be the continued disunity we have now where you have 15 airline unions competing with each other while wages are driven down. We think the crisis is that you have disunity now and you don't have a plan, you don't have unions working together, and because everybody puts the same initials after their name doesn't mean we're working together. We think the best thing to do is rebuild the House of Labor by taking the unions that really believe in change and really believing in organizing, and we work together. We want to work with the AFL on a local level. We want to partner where it makes sense. And we actually think it's not that big a deal that we're not working together nationally. The real work is on the grassroots level, and there people will continue to work together, and what happens in Chicago won't be such a, I think, won't be a major matter there.
So you say there are great disagreements, but a split isn't a split.
Well, we're saying that there's a split at the top, that we have basic philosophical differences. We believe they're not changing quickly enough. We believe that they're not willing to force the kind of unity that's needed, the unity of action and unity of planning, not just the unity of rhetoric, but that on the local level, at central labor councils and state feds, that our unions will stay involved, that where there's good work going on, we'll be engaged. We'll also be engaged with all sorts of community and other unions that aren't in the AFL-CIO. We think what's exciting is that there's an opportunity for people to work together where it makes sense, and there's an opportunity for those of us who have a different kind of vision of how to organize to work together where it does make sense.
We'll continue this recorded conversation after a very brief break, and when we come back, you will hear these guests and others respond to a poll by the Zogby organization, which showed that 1 in 3 of the workers they polled would vote to join a union, whereas 56% of them would not. The poll was done for a conservative organization, but it was done by the Zogby Poll, a well-respected group. We'll be right back with this archived edition of To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're on Only Back with To the Point, talking today about the labor movement in the United States. Nobody denies that it is losing numbers and losing clout. We now have a formal division of the biggest one since the Depression. Between major unions pulling out of the AFL-CIO, and we've just heard what the arguments are, or what some of the arguments are, on both sides. I want to get back to that poll in a moment, which may or may not demonstrate the case that the union movement is in sad straits at this point. First, though, I want to turn to the senior editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal, a paper which had an editorial in today's edition about the split in the AFL-CIO. The Wall Street Journal, of course, not to be expected to be in favor of unions as opposed to management. Kim Strussel is, again, senior editorial writer for the paper, and good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
The editorial in your paper today effectively says that neither side of the labor movement gets it. Explain.
Well, I think the argument that we were trying to make today is that most of the discussion that's going on right now around the convention and the unions pulling out has been about tactics. How do we go about organizing in better ways? What way can we use our money most effectively to have the most clout? How should we court certain politicians in different ways? No one's actually talking about the message that union leaders have been sending to workers and whether or not that's a message that anyone actually responds to and is willing to therefore join a union over. I mean, the number of union workers as a percentage of, you know, the U.S. economy has been on sliding for years and years now, and we seem to not have a union leadership that has stepped back and sort of said, maybe we're failing to connect to people, maybe we're not offering them a vision, maybe they don't see a reason to organize, to come and belong to a union. And just to correct you, we don't have anything against unions as so long as they're actually working on behalf of workers.
You are, though, certainly one of the major conservative voices in the country at the moment, usually associated with corporations and Republicans rather than unions and Democrats.
Well, we basically are there for people who believe the most in free markets and free people. So.
Okay. All right. What would you, however you may feel about unions, suggest as a better message to workers than the ones they're getting now?
Well, I think that one thing we're seeing happen is, especially there's a lot of younger workers today, they look around, they realize that we're in a global economy, we're in an information economy, they see tech companies coming along, and they're not willing to necessarily go along with a lot of the things that unions, we're no longer in an industrial age where companies are simply just wreaking profits and trampling down the workers. A lot of workers understand that their own success at a company depends on their company succeeding too. And in that regard, when you look at a lot of the unions who've poured money into Democratic causes and Democrats who have voted for higher taxes, who voted for anti-trade policies, who are voting to against private social security accounts or for more privatized health care, I think a lot of workers look and say, is this necessarily something that's going to help my company? I mean, it can't possibly help GM to actually be saddled with such huge health care costs that it ends up having to lay off people because those are fewer jobs for people out there. And I think one of the things we were asking was, where is the union leader who comes out and says, you know, we should be for private social security accounts so that workers can actually save money for their own benefit and that they will have that at the end of their lives and they don't have to depend on the success or failure of a pension plan or like the airlines. They don't have to sit back and just hope that it doesn't actually go bankrupt in the end and that they won't get anything in the end. Or where are the union leaders who are supporting some sort of competitive health care that allows workers to have portable health care that they can take from job to job? Or where are labor leaders who are supporting more flexible work environments rather than having sort of rigid work rules where seniority rules, it's about rewarding people who work hard. And I think that younger workers in particular look at that and they say, these are not organizations that are fighting for my best interests and I have no reason to join.
Kim Strassel, again, senior editorial writer at The Wall Street Journal. Back to Stephen Lerner, again, with the Service Employees International Union moving away from the AFL-CIO. What do you resonate at all with any of the issues just listed by Kim Strassel?
Well, the only thing I'd agree with her on is that the economy is changing radically and unions haven't adopted, and we need to adopt. And one of the things that we've said is unions have made lots of mistakes in not adopting to those changes. But the solution isn't for us, or none of her solutions are the correct solution. What we've said, for example, is the way you deal with companies competing against each other is you have to organize all of them at the same time so that when workers get raises, it doesn't put their company at a competitive disadvantage because everybody's paying the same wage rate. We've said the way you deal with globalization is we're now working with unions in other countries that have the same company is to organize them simultaneously in multiple countries. So we believe you have to offer new solutions based on how the economy is reorganized, but those are should be based on how workers win a better life and how we deal with the modern economy. So, for example, we do have portable pension plans. We do have portable health care plans. The struggle is to gain the strength to make sure that companies pay into them and support them. So I think what she's correctly saying is we need to change, but her solutions offer little to the average worker.
Do your solutions, Stephen Lerner, still depend on the industrial model in the sense that it is assumed that workers and management have a fundamental disagreement that can only be worked out through negotiation and bargaining?
Well, our solutions are based on the fact that you have giant corporations whose primary motivation is not to provide jobs, but is to make money, and that you need to equalize and level that playing field. What's interesting, though, is one of the reasons we're being successful is many of the employers we are organizing are what you would call subcontractors or outsourced in the new economy. So what we've realized we have to do is look at all different ways to help workers become stronger. So we've worked to where there's now $1 trillion of pension capital. And when it invests in an office building, it says, we think it's a better investment if you pay workers decently, the subcontracted workers, because we get better cleaning. So we look at all the different ways you can build worker strength, from pension fund power to how you get political and religious and other kind of support to equalize a playing field. Because actually what's really happening is corporations are becoming stronger, and it makes there even greater need for unions.
Kim Stressel, what about that? The corporations getting stronger, particularly in the current political environment? SEIU is suggesting this industry-wide organization so that companies aren't competing against one another. You can have portable benefits. Isn't that a way of dealing with the issues you raised?
Well, actually, I mean, there isn't any way. I think it's a laudable idea if you want to try to go out and organize everyone. But, I mean, it's not going to work. You're always going to – the whole idea of a competitive market, which is what we live in today, is that there is always going to be a company, there is always going to be a country with companies in it that are going to be more efficient, have workers who are more capable at doing the jobs they do and doing them well, and that you're going to have competition between those companies. I mean, it's all well and good to make sure that, for instance, General Motors is unionized across all the countries that it operates in, but there are always going to be other car companies that you don't unionize who are going to do it better. The question is, who can do this most competitively? And in that regard, workers have an incentive to be involved with making sure that corporations aren't working in a high-tax environment, aren't over-regulated, aren't actually all these things that drive up costs and make it harder for U.S. companies in particular to compete with in the global arena.
Andy Levin, let me get you back in this conversation again with the AFL-CIO, the Voice at Work campaign. And let me ask you, by way of response to Kim Stressel, what about this Zogby International poll, which shows that just 1 in 3, 35% of non-union workers would consider voting to unionize, while 56% would not? Again, it's the Zogby poll done for a conservative group, but nonetheless with the imprimatur that Zogby has. Why is that the case?
Well, first of all, Warren, if those people unionized, we would have the highest percentage of our workforce unionized in the history of the United States.
With the 35%, if you just got that.
Added to the percent that we have today.
Okay.
So that's wouldn't be a terrible thing. The problem is that workers are not free to form unions in this country. We think we have better polling than Zogby. As you said, he's polling for a very conservative, basically an outright anti-union organization, an organization whose reason for being is the destruction of unionization of the public sector. Whereas we have done polls every year for years, the Peter Hart organization, that asks workers in a more neutral way if they'd like to be members of unions or not. And our polling says that 53% of non-union workers would like to be in unions. That would amount to 57 million more workers in unions. Not all workers, but a lot of non-union workers would like to be in unions. And the reason is that collective bargaining is the way we built the middle class in this country. It's the way workers got pensions. It's the way workers got health insurance against the wishes of the Wall Street Journal, which oppose, you know, these things all the way. And workers need collective bargaining today.
Well, what do you mean when you say they're not free to form unions?
Well, in the United States today, employers are perfectly free, it's perfectly legal for them to subject workers to mandatory anti-union meetings. They can fire them for not coming to these meetings. They can fire them for coming if they're worried that they'll come and speak up and ruin their perfect anti-union intimidation session. Direct supervisors are free under our law to call you in and say, Warren, they close the door and they say, Warren, I just want you to know, I think this union thing would be really bad for both of us. Do you understand? They're free to campaign against unionization all day, every day on work time, whereas pro-union workers and are not allowed to campaign at all on work time, and union staff can be arrested, and Stephen and I have both been threatened with arrest many times for going on company property. So it's so bad that Human Rights Watch did a year-long investigation and in 2000 declared that the United States is fundamentally out of compliance with international human rights norms in this area. Our National Labor Relations Board fines every year 20,000 workers on average in the last several years have had their work their rights violated, and they are given some back pay, a little bit of back pay, usually years after their rights were violated. So we have a major campaign to restore the freedom to form unions in this country, and until now, the service employees and the Teamsters have both participated. And we've got federal legislation called the Employee Free Choice Act, which would allow workers to organize freely. And the ironic thing is that somebody like Kim ought to be in favor of a free market for worker representation.
Let me ask her that question, put that to her. Kim Strassel with the Wall Street Journal. What about it?
Oh, I think it'd be great if you could have a free market for this. But I think that what no one else is talking about here is the way that you're compelled to do things if you belong to a union. How many states are there where if you do not want to belong to the union that is in your company, you are forced to, and you are forced to pay your dues whether or not you ever wanted to be part of that organization in the first place. You are also forced to sit by as much of that money goes as the union pours it into often candidates who you don't support in elections. So, I mean, there's a lot that we could discuss here about people's rights and workers' rights in particular, and that isn't entirely the entire story.
All right. Let me go back to our very first guest, Harold Meyerson, who, again, is editor-at-large of the American Prospect. That is, compared to the Wall Street Journal, certainly a liberal publication. He's also a columnist for the Washington Post and political editor and columnist for the LA Weekly. How is all of this playing out politically? To what extent has the labor movement become, as it has been charged, a satellite of the Democratic Party? And if labor vote is up for grabs in the way that Stephen Lerner suggested it might be, with supportive for independents and Republicans at the same time, would that be good or bad for American workers?
Well, the decisive change in American politics took place when the Republican Party shifted from Northeast and Midwest roots and a tradition that was somewhat comfortable with unions to its Sunbelt more conservative aspect over the last 30 years, more or less destroying any tolerance for unions in the Republican Party, except for a relatively small percentage of Midwest and Northeast elected Republicans. So the tilt towards Democrats has kind of been really forced by large changes in the two parties. There's, you know, both the unions that have left and the remaining unions in the AFL-CIO share a fundamental political orientation. There is almost, I'd say, a generational difference among some labor leaders as to the degree to which the Democratic Party either rings bells positively or not. The leaders of some younger labor leaders who maybe spent a lot of time organizing in the South are a little more distanced from the label Democrat, just as a reaction to that experience. But on the whole, there's really a pretty consistent commitment to doing politics generally for Democrats because they are the more pro-labor or less anti-labor of the two parties. It cuts across all sides in the current dispute.
All right. Well, let me go back and finish up with our two guests from the different sides of organized labor, and first go to Stephen Lerner with the Service Employees International Union. You said earlier that there is an intent to work at the local level with AFL-CIO unions, presumably not to raid each other's members and that sort of thing. Do you think that there can be ultimately a reorganization and that the AFL-CIO can get back together with the SEIU and the Teamsters ever consider that at least anytime soon?
I think the right question to ask is how do we start to win again? How do we start to succeed? And it may be that if we start growing and we start winning in the way we should and workers start regaining health insurance and pension plans, that we come up with a totally different kind of organization that we should all be part of. I don't think the primary question anymore is a union in the AFL-CIO or not in the AFL-CIO. The question is, what is our vision and who are we working with to try to change this country? And where it makes sense to work with the AFL-CIO, we'll do it. But where it doesn't, we'll partner with other people. And we think we need to start looking for the future, not reflecting on the past, and that there's incredible opportunities out there, and we hope to take advantage of them.
Andy Levin with the AFL-CIO, what do you think is the right question to ask?
Well, I think that I think Stephen's question about the vision for the future is absolutely a correct question to ask. The problem is that we fundamentally agree on it. So you've got a situation where, for example, one of the members of the Change to Win coalition, which has not seceded from the AFL-CIO, Unite Here, which represents a lot of hotel workers, has won the sort of freedom to organize agreements from 25 hotels in recent years through the actions of the local central labor councils, going to cities, counties, when there's convention centers, when they're leasing property, when they're tied to a new hotel that's going to be built, and said, look, if you want to build this hotel, the workers are going to have to be free to organize. And, you know, that works when we all work together, and it doesn't work when we go and divide ourselves. And I hope that we can have everybody come back into the House of Labor and have one united front against the corporate onslaught that is trying to tear down workers' rights and workers' progress in this country.
Thanks to all of the guests who joined us on this archived edition of To the Point and 11 of the Voice at Work campaign of the AFL-CIO, Kim Stressel, a senior editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal, Stephen Lerner, director of property services for the SEIU, and Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect, columnist for the Washington Post and the LA Weekly. In a moment, Reporter's Notebook on this Labor Day edition of To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Mormon Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. After the first Gulf War ended in 1991, Saddam Hussein began a campaign to drain Iraq's southern marshes, home to the Marsh Arabs and their ancient culture. 9,000 square kilometers of marshes were reduced to just 760. Since the U.S. invasion of 2003, the United Nations has been working to restore that massive resource. Klaus Töpfer heads the U.N.'s environmental program. Mr. Töpfer, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
How much of the area has been restored?
Well, we are very happy to inform that due to satellite pictures, we are now back to something 37 to up to 40%, even in summertime. In springtime, it goes up to 50% already due to the better water supply from the Tigris and the Euphrates. But the tendency is very clear. It is possible to restore, but the job is by far not yet done, and a lot of additional problems have to be solved.
Before we get to that, let me ask you, why is it that Saddam Hussein wanted to drain the marshes?
Well, you see, there's quite a total care of reason. On the one side, there was really the intention to destroy this very old ethnic group of the Marsh Arabs, 5,000 years old culture, of course, totally adopted to those ecological conditions there. There were very, very intensive tensions between the Saddam regime and those Arabs. That was for sure one of the reasons. But we have also, of course, the decision to have more projects for irrigation upstream the two mentioned river, especially in those parts in the middle of Iraq, to have better agricultural possibilities. And there are other reasons as well, but it was without any doubt a very targeted attempt, especially also to punish the Marsh Arabs and to destroy their culture.
Have any substantial number of people been able to return as you have been able to restore the 37 to 40% you said is the case in the summer?
Yes, there is, of course, a clear movement in this direction, but as I mentioned before, we are not ready with the work, especially with the quality of the drinking water. There's a lot of work to do further, and also with the overall restoration of the ecological and therefore also the production side of agriculture. All this is not yet finished. It would be also a miracle if after only a very limited time, this always comes back to where it was for all the time before. So it is not surprising that this is a process and not only a moment to change and everybody comes back. It is also necessary to restore the infrastructure there. because there must be also from schools to the sewage water treatment and all this. That is really a challenge for the future, and we are very aware of this, and I'm very happy that we have the backing for this from the global family. I have to praise, especially in this case, the Japanese government, who gave us a financial possibility to do the work until now. And we are very sure that this environmentally sound technologies we are using there are also a good example for other regions. And you know that we are going in 2 weeks' time to the summit in New York for the summit of the Millennium Development Goals. And to prove that environment is a precondition for fighting poverty is a very good example there as well.
We're talking with Klaus Töpfer, who heads the UN's environmental program, about the restoration of the marshes in southern Iraq. Have the Iraqis themselves and any institutions of the current Iraqi government been involved in the restoration process?
Absolutely. That is really an Iraqi-driven project. That is not coming from abroad. So we need, of course, great help of NGOs from around the world, also in their knowledge, but it is driven by Iraq government itself. We are very closely working together with the Ministry for Environment, with the minister herself. We are working together with the Ministry of Local Administration and others. There is a specific body for the marshlands, integrating some different ministries and the regional activities, of course, as well. I personally had the chance to speak with those sheikhs responsible in this region when I had the chance to be in Amman, and we invited them. We are bringing a lot of people from Iraq outside, because unluckily, due to the security situation, we cannot go to be there. So we invite them to come, and we are educating, we are teaching them, and they are doing the job then mainly also themselves with a good backing by our experts. So there is a lot of very clear ownership of the Iraqi government as well.
You mentioned that a great deal of the problem now remaining is to improve the quality of the drinking water. How has it become so polluted?
Well, you see, if you have no real working sewage water treatment upstream, the problem for the downstreamers is very clear. We have a lot of those consequences. There is a channel going to the Shatt el-Arab quite now, what was very, very heavily polluted with sewage coming from upstream. So there's a lot of those reasons that the water, the drinking water, has to be cleaned and restored. What we are doing, and indeed we try to do it with those technologies, are very close to the environmental sustainability. There was a very, very outstanding experience in this region that you can rely on nature to clean sewage water to some extent, and we try to restore this as well.
I understand that upstream of the Tigris and Euphrates, there are also dams in Turkey and Syria and Iran as well. To what extent have they impeded the flow, and do they make it more difficult to keep it, to get it going again, and to improve the southern marshes of Iraq?
First and foremost, we have, of course, to underline that there is an existing legal arrangement between those riparian countries of the Euphrates and the Tigris, integrating, of course, Turkey and Syria and Iraq, to mention this, that there is also the possibility to make the water better used in the whole region. So the main question is not only linked and limited to the marshlands, the so-called Garden of Eden itself, but it is mainly linked also how to use and what was the use of the water upstream, and specifically, as I mentioned, in the center of Iraq. There are quite a lot of those irrigation schemes, and if you use the water there, it's not available downstream. And we made the same assessment, of course, also with regard to Iran, because the marshlands are transboundary in this region, and there is a similar situation that there must be a clear, coordinated work in the future to bring this so important wetland, these marshes, back to the status where people can live there in their old culture, and where we have also a contribution beyond the direct situation in Iraq, because those marshlands have a huge importance also for biodiversity, and this not only on the region but also on the global level.
Klaus Töpfer, heading the UN Environmental Program, thanks again.
Thank you very much indeed. Goodbye.
Today's Labor Day program, produced by Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Jonah King, and Karen Radziner, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.